Hello, welcome to another episode of Trust and Trade, a podcast produced by the Antitrust Law Section of the American Bar Association. Trust and Trade is a podcast for seasoned practitioners interested in deep dives into the areas of competition, consumer protection, and privacy law, and casual listeners tuning in to hear expert discussion of some of the hot-button issues in these fields. Each episode is presented by one of the specialty committees within the section. This episode is produced and co-hosted by the Intellectual Property Committee of the Antitrust Law Section. Today's episode asks, have IP remedies in big tech antitrust cases gone too far? Joining me today is my co-host, Jennifer Dixon, lecturer at the UCLA School of Law. Jennifer is a former colleague of mine from the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, where she was an assistant chief for the Competition Policy and Advocacy Section and Special Counsel for Intellectual Property. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks, Anant. It's a pleasure to be on the show today. I will say, though, that none of my remarks, of course, reflect my former employer's ideas or my current employer, but I'm really happy to share my thoughts today and speak to our guests.
Well, and it was a great idea that you came to us with. So let me give people a little bit of background here. Starting with the first Trump administration and then carrying through the Biden administration into Trump II, big tech companies have been the subject of antitrust litigation in cases brought by federal enforcers, but also by private plaintiffs. So the DOJ brought two monopolization cases against Google and has already won one on the monopolization of search issue. FTC and DOJ have collectively brought cases against Amazon, Facebook, and Apple. And meanwhile, Epic Games sued Apple and Google for alleged anti-competitive app store practices. Now, Jennifer, what jumped out at you in these cases is the nature of some of the proposed remedies.
Absolutely. Both the private plaintiffs and the government certainly have been successful in some of these cases in proving monopolization, either through exclusive dealing, tying, creating other barriers to entry for competitors. And soon now we're going to see what antitrust remedies will be put in place to address this conduct. But several of these remedies involve the forced sharing of technology and proprietary information. So I find that really interesting. For example, in the Google search case, the government and state plaintiffs have sought a remedy that would require, among other things, data sharing, including user-side data relating to Google search index and information and data that would allow competitors to recreate Google's knowledge graph. It also requires the syndication of Google's search results at marginal cost. In the Epic case, some similar relief that the court has ordered, which is currently being considered by the Ninth Circuit. The court ordered their nationwide injunction extending to Epic and third-party app developers. And this injunction requires Google to do some things that require sharing. For example, Google has to permit third-party Android app stores to access the Google Play Store's catalog of apps and share that with these third-party app stores. The court, you know, thought that this remedy was necessary to level the playing field after Google's conduct that made it difficult for them to compete. And as I said, that remedy is still on appeal. But all of these remedies sort of require this sharing of proprietary information that these companies obviously may not want to share with their competitors.
But it is two distinct types of IP remedies that we're talking about here. You have a data licensing remedy, and then like almost like a mandated interoperability type remedy. The first requiring the company to share their own internally generated, acquired first-party data with a rival. And the second is this app store that you created and whose rules you set, you now have to open up to third-party developers. And maybe the analogy is less mandated interoperability, but more like the forced carriage type requirements we see under FCC obligations for cable providers. But it's almost like you've created this enormously popular restaurant, and it's so popular that you now have to let your customers sell baked goods from their table. Or am I mischaracterizing that a little bit?
No, I mean, certainly, I'm sure that's how, you know, some of these companies like Google feel that, you know, they created this great product and everybody wants to come to their restaurant for their great catalog of apps, right? And now, you know, they have to share that with the restaurant down the street that might not have as great a food. So, you know, this is the issue, and whether or not this disincentivizes companies to invest in their restaurant, right? To make their food really good. So we're going to explore that today. We're going to talk to a couple of guests that have some great perspectives on whether or not we should be worried about innovation incentives, whether we should be worried about for sharing. And we have to remember that these companies have been adjudicated monopolists. So we're not, you know, determining whether they engaged in wrongful conduct at this stage. We're actually thinking about what the proper remedy is. And should we think about innovation incentives differently at the remedy phase versus the liability stage?
So Jennifer, who are our guests on this edition of IP Love Island?
Today on our show, we have Joe Jerome. Joe has a JD from New York University School of Law, and his career in technology and law and policy has crisscrossed civil society, academia, industry, and in private practice. He is currently senior public policy manager at DuckDuckGo, a privacy technology company. Keith Weir is our second guest. He is an economist with a PhD from Rutgers University and has had teaching posts at Rutgers, BYU, Johns Hopkins, and University of Maryland. Keith has more than 25 years working on a wide range of antitrust issues in government, including at the Antitrust Division. He's a former Antitrust Division alum, and in private practice. Currently, he is a managing director at Secretariat Advisors. And so those are our guests today. So I'm really excited to talk more with Keith and Joe. So let's start with Keith. Keith, the government argues in some of these cases that the courts have a duty to approve a remedy that will restore workable competition to the market. My question is, at what cost to innovation incentives? Can remedies like the ones we've been discussing that require the for sharing of data or proprietary technology or access actually threaten innovation incentives?
I think the answer is, of course, yes, that's possible. But I think, you know, it's useful to think about the innovation incentives and remedies in a few different ways. And just to kind of level set here. So, you know, anti-competitive foreclosure and conduct that negatively impacts the innovation incentives of rival firms. So not having a remedy also affects innovation. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that not all innovation incentives are equal. And I think it's useful to think about two categories of how a remedy might affect innovation incentives. One is probably more important, or at least in my mind, is more important than the other. So there are direct effects of remedies on innovation incentives. And the way I think about those is that somehow the remedy is reducing the return on future investments to innovation. And I would count those as being the ones that we should be more concerned about. The other category is indirect effects. So those would be the kind of situation where I've invested a bunch yesterday, I'm expecting a return tomorrow, but the government and the courts have stepped in and taken away those benefits from me. Now, those investments are already sunk, so we're really not infecting those investments. But people might think that, well, next time I go around thinking about making an innovation incentive, I might worry about the fact that I had those benefits taken away in the past.
Joe, do you have any reaction to Keith's point? Are, you know, some, sort of sunk costs less important? What should we be concerned about here?
So, I mean, I might be paraphrasing or repeating what you said up top, but the reason that we are here is because Google's anti-competitive actions, which have already been adjudicated and found by a court, have power, it was, were found to have powered a feedback loop of different network effects that ensure basically an insurmountable and, as the judge put it, quote, perpetual scale and quality deficit for competitors. So when you're talking about, you know, Google has put up a lot of arguments here about how, you know, these remedies are going to impact its ability to innovate. But from our position as a competitor, Google has basically created a whole lot of ill-gotten data that is blocking a lot of innovation. You know, I think it's important to distinguish what the DOJ is proposing here. There is a difference between search syndication as it exists in the market and the DOJ's search syndication remedy. The DOJ is proposing to allow, you know, basically for any query that you put into a search engine, a competitor would have access to those same search results. And in the context of search, I think it's easy to think about search as just, you know, a bunch of links, and that really what the DOJ is proposing is to let everybody copy Google's links. But that isn't really how search operates. And, you know, I know this is not a podcast on AI, but as we enter into AI, like, search is a whole bunch of different modules. It's links, it's knowledge panels, it's increasingly AI assistants. And each of those things are different modules that, you know, from DuckDuckGo's perspective, you know, we envision competitors doing lots of unique and creative things with that. Everybody just copying what Google's already doing, there's no business model in that. There's no reason for anybody to leave Google if everybody's just going to offer the exact same thing. Instead, if companies can take what Google has offered and build on that and not be, frankly, restricted or encumbered in their ability to do interesting things with it, we use the terminology like re-ranking and remixing. But if competitors can portray search results and search modules in different and unique ways or in more personalized ways, we actually think that unlocks a tremendous amount of innovation in the search market. And it does nothing to impact Google's existing and tremendous brand equity and position in the market.
You're talking about the syndication. You mentioned the syndication remedy. How common is syndication in search in the first place, absent the remedy? And second, I think you got into this a little bit, but the case law, when it comes to antitrust remedies, says that a remedy must be able to unfetter a market from anti-competitive conduct and pry open to competition a market that has been closed by defendants' illegal conduct, right? So that's the argument, that the remedy must open this market up, must allow for competition. So how does syndication and even the data sharing actually accomplish this goal? And can you just tell us in a little more specific way how this would help a company, how this remedy would help a company compete?
That's an excellent question. And it's probably something that I would have had before I started working at DuckDuckGo, a search company, because I think in general, and this has been Google's argument, and I don't mean to cast too much shade on this, but Google's argument is that competition is just one click away, that it's plenty easy to just go to duckduckgo.com if you want to change from Google. But part of the challenge here is that search engines, you know, basically rely on data. The more data they have, the better their results can be. And the problem is, as Google has swallowed up and maintained a monopoly across all sorts of search access points, whether that's browsers, operating systems, or just other sort of search access points on phone devices, they get all of the queries, which makes it very hard for other competitors to understand how search works. Because really, search is an incredibly data-intensive business. You're trying to understand what all sorts of people want based on different types of context, based on types of location. And the end result of Google's monopoly maintenance is that they just, again, have a huge data advantage. So, you know, some of the remedies that propose that we also, you know, are supportive of are things like choice screens. And you know, Google has proposed basically sort of loosening up some of the exclusive arrangements that they have with different companies on these search access points. If you do that, you don't change the status quo, because you still aren't providing avenues by which competitors can get more data to improve their products. And so to get back to your actual question, that's what syndication does. It helps immediately jumpstart competition by giving competitors access to build on Google's data. You also asked how common syndication is. You know, again, I think that's a really good question because the dynamics of how the search market work are interesting. Like, there are companies like Google that have the entire tech stack. They have a web index. They query that index to produce results. They also have an advertising platform on the side of it. And, you know, the other things that get a little bit into the weeds here are they have a tremendous amount of information about local localities, you know, restaurants, business hours, stuff that is very hard to do at scale, like to understand what's going on in small town. They have this entire stack. There are other entities that have pieces of the stack. So there are companies that are building competitive indexes in bits and pieces. There are also companies like DuckDuckGo that offer sort of the search results, but it's not just DuckDuckGo. We've got companies like Ecosia and Quant. These are European search engines that have slightly different focuses. And for these companies, we syndicate search results from other companies. So this is already common. Google already syndicates its search results. They do them in under very restrictive terms most of the time, but not always. I think one thing that was very, very interesting about the Google case is that the Department of Justice's syndication remedy is actually based off of the arrangement that Google currently has with Yahoo Japan. And this highlights, again, the data issues that I think are inexorably intertwined with competition in search. Yahoo Japan, I mean, Yahoo in the United States is a much smaller player, though still, you know, a viable search engine. But Yahoo Japan is uniquely influential in the Japanese market, so much so that it is a pretty strong competitor to Google. And so Google benefits from this relationship with Yahoo Japan to better understand some of the data context that they're missing in that market. And so they offer Yahoo Japan the ability to understand how Google's results are being ranked, change things around, produce synthetic queries. That's a unique remedy in the Department of Justice. So syndication, all to say, in the search market is actually pretty common.
Thanks, Joe. I wanted to give Keith an opportunity to comment on the syndication aspect of the remedy. Should we be concerned about syndication? Joe says it's fairly common, or you know, companies do this, but, you know, should we be concerned about it as a remedy?
I do think that we should be concerned about it, but in the end, I think I'm going to come around a bit to Joe's side on this, and I'll just explain kind of how I get there. So first, you know, some of the scary parts of it, it's 10 year syndication. Right, where Google needs to provide this at marginal cost, which is pretty much zero. Now, I think we could argue, people could reasonably argue, should it be 10 years? Should it be shorter than that? And, you know, I was just at a conference where I was on a panel where there was a little bit of discussion about this, and an eminent economist from the US who was on the panel with me thought, well, what kind of crazy things does this create for innovation incentives? And I think there's two innovation incentives here to think about. One is Google's innovation in the organic search results and whether they still have any incentive to kind of try to improve those results. And the other question is, what about the innovation incentives for rivals to create their own version of Google? So I think there's definitely an open question about, well, how much incentive does the rivals going to have with a 10-year term for syndication? I don't know what to think about the how long it should be. Let me just turn to the Google incentives. So I think Google right now has limited incentives to really improve organic search. It seems like a mature technology to me. And if you think about kind of two-sided markets where one side doesn't pay a price, you know, often a monopolist will have an incentive to continue to innovate because they can make their product more valuable to consumers and charge a higher price. But on the consumer side of Google, they're not charging a price. So there's really, you know, improving the experience for consumers, they're not able to really extract more value, and they've already, you know, captured all the consumers or a lot of the searches. They're not really getting marginal searches anymore. Now you open up the syndication, that creates a big incentive for rivals to create better user experiences, including reducing the number of ads, reducing the clutter on search pages. I'm actually looking forward to some of that innovation, but I think, you know, there's still open questions about the 10 years and also kind of whether or not we're really hampering the incentives for others to generate their own search.
And for one comment on the syndication remedy that Keith has prompted me to think about is that the syndication remedy, in a sense, I think some of the discomfort people feel with it is that it's almost as though the DOJ is now changing where the market competes. Because if now if competitors can just skin a Google search engine with their own features, then as Keith said, you can now compete on other parameters, quality parameters, privacy, ads. And, you know, we, I think, generally agree that quality are valid metrics for competition, but it's almost as though the enforcer here is shifting where they think an entire market should compete.
Sure. And I think on quality is certainly valuable for consumers, right? So you can see the benefit of having different options as a consumer as to where you want to, you know, invest your time and what protections you want when you're online. So the question is, you know, can we do both? Can we continue to have a great search experience and make sure that there's investment in search, there's AI, you know, that is going to really change how we search. So we want to make sure the incentives are there. One question, you know, that comes to mind about the remedy that Keith just mentioned with respect to syndication and other aspects of the data sharing remedy is at what cost, you know, so if there's some compensation maybe to Google for sharing, then maybe the incentives for innovation continue. But here, you know, the remedy calls for sharing at marginal cost. So Keith, you know, I know you've done a lot of work on calculating a reasonable rate for a royalty. So sometimes a remedy requires sharing at a reasonable rate. The court may require a defendant to provide some sort of asset at a reasonable rate. Here, we're talking about marginal rate. Is there a difference? Does it matter at what rate the defendant is actually compensated for sharing in the context of a remedy?
That's a good question. And just you've said that I've done a lot of calculations. I really haven't done calculations on this particular problem. I have done reasonable royalty calculations for like music royalties and other things like that. So I don't want to, you know, say that I know what the right answer is here, but let me just say how you would think about how to set what the right royalty is. So, you know, let's just take an example. Let's say, you know, Google search right now, Google's making say 4 cents on each search. And we'll just say the marginal cost is probably zero, but let's just call it zero. So the margin is 4 cents. Now, if they now are syndicating, you know, at initially the syndicators are going to be making 4 cents per search, that gives them a lot of incentive to try to innovate and attract more searches to their search engine. Now they can capture from Google, they can capture from the other syndicators. That's a large incentive. And so then the question is, what can they do to attract that? Are those investments, those things that they're doing, good for consumers? On the other hand, if you leave more money with Google, you know, that creates an incentive to try to attract more searches for everybody, right, at 4 cents. And then the question is there room for them to do that? Is there room for them to actually make investments that would attract more searches in general, because they're not really, you know, they're making it from everybody, all the syndicators. And so you've got to balance those two incentives, whether in this case, marginal cost is the right one. I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in this case, and I haven't done the calculation. You know, my armchair look at these things would say that I think there's more room for innovation by the syndicators at this point than mature technology like organic search.
Can I jump in? Because Keith, thank you. You're basically making my arguments for me. I am not an economist by training, and I was frankly terrified that I would have to be talking about economics terms as a tech policy lawyer. But I do think it is important just for people to understand, and I said this up top, that, you know, when we say search syndication, I think, again, people tend to think of search as like results, when really it's about modules. And the Department of Justice's remedy is very much focused on these modules. So, you know, and again, I don't want to throw out all sorts of numbers, but there's probably different costs for different modules. Is the module about local search results? Again, sort of understanding, you know, what are the hours for a local restaurant versus the sort of traditional 10 blue links versus increasingly what we're seeing on basically everybody now is AI-assisted search. Those are all different things and all different modules that can be syndicated. And really what the Department of Justice is trying to make available is for people to pick and choose that. So we're talking about innovation. DuckDuckGo has, I don't mean this as the plug it will come out as, has spent a lot of time, money, resources, building AI tools and AI-assisted search at the top of our search results. You know, our CEO has been pretty clear that, like, in a universe where this remedy is available, we don't want to syndicate AI results from Google. We don't want to syndicate AI results from anybody. That's something we're building ourselves. And so, again, the syndication remedy isn't, you know, admittedly, if you did want to just sort of copy and paste Google whole cloth, maybe you could do that. But that isn't going to be viable long term. And Keith, you know, you mentioned the time frame duration. I think that's important. From our perspective, we're like, you know, these are time limited remedies in any case of the word. So even if you were just going to do copy and paste for 10 years, then what? It's not clear you're going to be able to build a viable tech company. And, you know, 10 years can go by in a blink of an eye in the search industry.
I want to move to a different aspect of these remedies, both in the Google search remedy and in the Epic remedy. The court is considering the possibility of a technical committee that would be in place to help with implementation of the remedy and to sort of adjudicate any problems with the remedy. Let's talk about what a technical committee is and what is its role. So, Keith, can you tell us a little bit about what a technical committee is? What does it do? Why would we want one?
Sure. So let me describe what at least the proposed final judgment for the DOJ in the Google search case, what is envisioned there, because it's pretty interesting. So the technical committee is going to be a committee of five people that have a combination of expertise in software engineering, information retrieval, artificial intelligence, economics and behavioral science. Good luck finding somebody that has all those things to check the box, but I'm assuming that the committee is going to somehow be a combination of a group that has those that expertise. Initially, the three parties, the DOJ, the plaintiff states, and Google will each appoint a single committee member. And then the other two will be voted on by a majority of the three that were initially set. The committee, or this technical committee, gets to hire their own staff and sometimes hire consultants to help them. And, you know, what do these folks do? They're generally there to monitor Google's compliance with the final judgment, or they would be if this is approved by the court. They're going to help define what Android is in terms of software API and other things, what Google Play Store is and what Chrome is for the final judgment. And then it sets and enforces various security protocols. To me, this all sounds like a little mini regulatory agency, which I think would start to cause most economists' hearts to beat a little faster. I am personally not somebody who says that all remedies have to be structural and not behavioral in some way. And I think there's a legitimate argument to be made whether or not, you know, there should be some sort of regulatory structure here that could be imposed by a court. You know, we've seen that before in ASCAP and BMI. It's kind of an interesting parallel there, but we'll see how this unrolls.
Joe, do you have some thoughts on the technical committee? How can this technical committee facilitate implementation of the remedy? How can it help really open the market to competition?
So I'm reluctant to say I'm a tech exceptionalist, but I think technical committees are really warranted in competition cases involving technology firms. And I think part of this is because lawyers and courts, you know, let's be honest, struggle to understand and grapple with technology. I think in this case, and in really all of these cases, the judges, including Judge Mehta, have done yeoman's work trying to wrap their heads around very complicated tech issues that are probably pretty far outside their training, but that creates a really challenging dynamic, whether it's Google or other tech companies that then, you know, once you put in place these remedies, having the expertise to understand what's going on behind the scenes is really, really, I think, difficult for lawyers to do. Hence why the technical committee being proposed here is supposed to be made up of members with wide-ranging expertise, because we're being completely honest, lawyers are not well suited to understand and manage how companies are going to be doing remedies involving data. You know, there's just a lot of technical capacity that has to be built there. You know, I want to highlight that technical committees aren't a new concept. The Microsoft antitrust case from 20 years ago had a technical committee, and that technical committee ultimately was put in place because Microsoft and the Department of Justice were having a really hard time agreeing on what was going on with different APIs, application programming interfaces, and other technical stuff behind the scenes. You know, Microsoft was, you know, starting from, both parties were like putting in something in place and then agreeing on it and starting over. And so you had a technical committee come in place and really sort of like whip the behavioral remedies imposed on Microsoft into shape. So much so that, you know, the Department of Justice, the judge overseeing that case, really saw the technical committee as one of the highlights and major success stories of the Microsoft consent decree. So it's a model that seems eminently appropriate here with Google, another tech company that's just very complicated to understand what's going on. You know, Keith mentions that it's, you know, it seems like almost a trial run for a mini regulatory agency. And there's probably some truth to that. The Assistant Attorney General, Gail Slater, you know, when this case was, when the remedy trial was being discussed, described this as no less than a case about the future of the internet. And in a universe where, at least in the United States, we really haven't had a lot of bespoke regulators focusing on tech platforms, this is really an opportunity to do, I think, or at least see a trial run of how we should be really regulating these firms that have tremendous amounts of both market power and, frankly, influence over how our society functions.
Joe, should we be concerned about sharing information now with the technical committee too?
So I'm going to try and put on my privacy lawyer and you know, privacy policy hat. I don't think so. I mean, I think that's an argument that folks make in opposition to a technical committee. But the reality is, A, this is a group full of experts that are here to understand how security protocols work. You know, if we're concerned about giving information or technical know-how to a technical committee, I don't see how that's any different from subpoenas to the government or, you know, or other legal processes to understand information. I think the other thing that's worth highlighting here is there, and this is sort of how the Microsoft technical committee worked, there's nothing stopping the technical committee from being embedded within Google. It's not like we are setting up a committee that's going to have an external company, and so information has to leave Google and go into another company. This can all be done within Google. So yes, it involves a technical committee seeing and having access to information, but, you know, presumably as members of this committee, they are beholden to all sorts of contractual agreements not to then go and leak or share this information elsewhere. That's how all sorts of consulting and third-party relationships already exist. I don't think that there's anything new and unique about what's being proposed.
I'll ask Joe and then I'll give Keith an opportunity to respond. I wanted to address something that the Supreme Court said a few years ago in the Alston case. It said that courts must be sensitive to the possibility that continuing supervision of a highly detailed decree could wind up impairing rather than enhancing competition. So is this a concern in these big tech cases that we've been discussing from your perspective? Should we be worried that this remedy is just going to be too hard to supervise despite the technical committee? Are we going too far in what's being proposed in some of these cases?
It's interesting, and I don't mean to be adversarial here, but this podcast is being framed as these remedies are going too far. I think you can make an argument that they're not going far enough. I think that, you know, tech companies, again, the sort of tech exceptionalism here, but, you know, tech companies and Google in particular, you know, like to take advantage of this idea that, or basically leverage technical speed and complexity to overwhelm the law. So, you know, Google has insisted that antitrust laws really aren't, you know, appropriate for governing its business here, and that, you know, antitrust laws really shouldn't have been, we're completely misunderstanding how antitrust should apply to digital markets. But here we have a case where Google was found to be violating the antitrust laws. The Department of Justice, you know, they have a reason to argue this, but they argued in their closing arguments a couple months ago that really what Google has proposed for itself is a handful of milquetoast remedies that it knows will maintain the status quo. Well, the goal of remedies after an adjudication of violating antitrust laws is not to maintain the status quo. You know, as Judge Mehta himself put it, you know, we all could have closed up shop if the only thing that was needed to be done here was to enter an injunction of the kind that Google is talking about. So both the judge and the Department of Justice have pushed back against this idea that, like, we should just sort of maintain the status quo. So we need to go ahead and do something here. And you know, I don't mean this as just sort of picking on Google, but I don't think companies can have it both ways. So Google has publicly sort of complained that the Department of Justice's proposal is too vague, and that probably gets at, Jennifer, your complexity question. It's too vague and hard to operationalize. But at the same time, it's also called the technical committee, which, I think is a great idea, government micromanagement. So we've got a vague decree and government micromanagement. You know, which is it? I think the reality here is that when you violate competition laws, and when you're a technology firm that has violated competition laws, there's going to be a degree of complexity to fix the situation, unless the goal is to maintain the status quo. Now, obviously, we could talk a little bit more about structural remedies, but I think, you know, again, a lot of companies tend to oppose those as well.
Keith, what are your thoughts? Are these behavioral remedies too complex for courts to administer, even with the implementation of a technical committee?
Yeah, I'll be brief. You know, I think this is a complex remedy. There's a lot of moving pieces. You've got a little mini regulatory agency being created with the technical committee. And I think in the end, it really comes down to, you know, is that warranted? Are we good? Can we have a change in industry structure through some of the structural remedies? Will the structure correct itself with less time, you know, with some of the behavioral remedies in place? You know, that really depends on whether this is some sort of natural monopoly kind of situation, kind of like I mentioned ASCAP and BMI before. I mean, that was one of these remedies where it's long lasting. It mimics what Congress has imposed in similar situations, right? And that was put together, you know, in terms of an antitrust case. You know, is it more like that, or should we be, you know, pushing for some more structural change and try to focus on that? Those are all open questions.
Keith, another question for you, and this sort of gets to what you were just saying about sort of the scope and really durability of the remedy and how long lasting it is. So Google's argued that any antitrust remedy should be no broader than necessary to address the illegal conduct, and that courts should be wary to impose a remedy that goes beyond, you know, sort of what the core anti-competitive conduct is, And, you know, any remedies that sort of permit cloning of its IP are really too severe. Should we be concerned about sort of the overall scope of the remedy suggested here, proposed in this Google case, or just in general, you know, should, when remedies really affect IP rights and it's not going to the core of the anti-competitive conduct, should courts be wary? Should courts be concerned? Should courts sort of use their discretion to tailor a remedy that really is focused on the core conduct rather than sort of reaching a little bit broader and affecting, you know, potential innovation incentives?
I'm a skeptic that of this idea that somehow if a remedy involves IP, it's somehow very different from other kinds of remedies. Just because, you know, you force a factory to be divested, that's affecting a different kind of investment. Now, maybe there's some kind of IP investment or innovation incentives that are perhaps more valuable than building a factory with robots. But I think we should be careful in thinking that somehow remedies that involve IP are special in some ways, and just be skeptical of some of those claims by defendants. Just in terms of scope, you know, I just think back to some of the remedies that I've seen, like in the merger environment, where, you know, there's a product line that is a problem, there's an overlap problem, and if a divestiture is needed and you've got to divest a factory, that factory also makes a bunch of other product lines. That's the nature of it, to fix the problem. And, you know, you don't want to go broader than you need to go, but sometimes you do have to, the scope of a remedy has to go beyond the scope of the immediate problem. And I think that factory example is an apt one in this situation.
But Keith, let me follow up with you on that by taking it a step further. So there was another remedy proposed by the DOJ in the search case, which was that if some of the earlier, more targeted remedies didn't work, the DOJ proposed that Google divest Android, the operating system, the mobile operating system. And what made some people, even non-Google people, uncomfortable about that is that there was nothing about the nature of Android that was alleged to be contributing to search monopolization. It was not part of the DOJ's case, but by virtue of divesting Android, this could create more access points for rivals to contest search markets. So moving away from Google for a second, I don't want this to just be a Google dunk tank, but let's take a hypothetical company that has a big patent portfolio. And let's say that this company has been found to have violated the antitrust laws, something Section 2E, you know, like attempted monopolization, some behaviors unrelated to its IP portfolio. But the enforcer comes out and says, this company is so far along in this market that in order to really reset the market, we are going to require them to license their patent portfolio to the rivals in order to give them a shot to make this market more contestable. Where do you draw the line on what kind of IP remedies to antitrust cases are appropriate?
I mean, I would say, you know, that I'll just go back to my factory analogy, where, you know, we're forcing the divestiture of a factory where, you know, one of the product lines is the product line that's at issue. I think I would have a problem if the court then ordered a second factory where none of the product lines that were at issue were being produced. Like, well, what's the link to that other factory? Why would that be necessary to? And that seems to me to go beyond the scope. I am not sure what the link of Android is in the Google case. Joe may know, but, you know, I think it's possible to go definitely beyond the scope of where a remedy should go. But I'm not sure that's happening here.
This may be a little bit of a punt, but, you know, I look at like the DOJ FTC antitrust IP guidelines, And, you know, they highlight that they can impose licensing requirements to remedy anti-competitive harm, and that licensing remedies, so, you know, we'll substitute search indication for just IP generally here, should be fact-specific and tailored. You say you can, you're asking where we can draw the line, and I just don't think you really can. I think you have to take a case-by-case approach. And, you know, as I've been arguing here, and again, not to make this a Google dunk thing, when it comes to search, data and search access points were a core component of the case above and beyond just sort of default agreements. And so the only way to really fix or restore competition is to A, unlock more data for competitors, or unlock more places for people, competitors, to launch their products. And so I think that's where the Department of Justice moves to some of the sort of divestiture remedies that have given you pause. And, you know, I think you would have to do that. I think you'd have to consider the facts of any one of these tech cases. And I don't think you can come up with a bright line rule, which is not satisfying.
Joe, I love that you cited the IP guidelines, because I'm a huge fan of the IP guidelines. And yes, the IP guidelines, you know, do say that a remedy should be, you know, tailored, and it's very fact specific. And I think that, you know, courts certainly have very broad discretion once the government proves liability, that, you know, they can order a remedy that's going to address the harm. So sometimes, you know, as Keith points out, that remedy, you know, really may affect IP rights, and certainly many remedies, you know, have ordered the sharing of IP rights. So we'll see, you know, what the scope of remedies actually is here in some of these cases once they're finalized.
We'd like to end these episodes with some takeaways for practitioners. So, Joe, let's start with you.
So I am increasingly a policy wonk, so not necessarily a practitioner. But from my vantage point, I think the lesson of the Google case, and really a lot of the antitrust action we're seeing right now, is really that the old rules don't apply. I live in the universe where I constantly am going to sessions on not just, you know, hipster antitrust, but MAGA antitrust. And the approaches of both of those things seem to just call for more aggressive A, cases, but also remedies. And so sort of, I think the old playbook of what companies can expect from antitrust remedies may not be appropriate.
Keith?
Yeah, so if you're a practitioner and you're thinking about trying to make an argument relating to innovation incentives relating to remedies, I would say keep a few things in mind to sharpen that those arguments. One is, you know, monopoly or anti-competitive foreclosure and not effectively remedying an issue will cause harm to innovation by rivals. And then, you know, on the other side, just keep in mind these two, the direct and indirect innovation incentives. And the direct innovation incentives are going to be the stronger arguments, at least in my mind, than the indirect ones. So the direct incentives are those that where the remedy itself reduces returns on future investments by the firm that's having to have the remedies imposed on them. And I'll leave it at that.
And Jennifer, what are your final thoughts?
So courts have really broad discretion in granting a remedy once liability has been found. And we have to remember that, you know, we're dealing with a monopolist. We have to address the monopolist's conduct. The company at this point at the remedy phase has been adjudicated a monopolist. So some of the concerns about, you know, innovation incentives may be slightly different at the remedies phase. An IP defense or an innovation defense may not necessarily be successful, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't consider innovation incentives or IP rights. It's a fact-specific inquiry, and, you know, it's up to the court to decide what the right remedy is. So I would suggest that, you know, if you're working with a client on an antitrust remedy, you're really going to have to convince a court that the remedy will be effective and not too difficult to administer, and, you know, that this remedy will do more good than harm for competition. So I think, you know, making arguments about what the proper remedy is, to just take those considerations into account.
Well, Jennifer, what a great issue. I think we really pulled at it from some different angles. And I suspect that this issue is something that we're going to see in the cases against Facebook, against Apple, against Amazon. So it is certainly evergreen territory. Thank you to Keith and thank you to Joe for excellent discussion on this topic. And to our listeners, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. And we'll see you next time on Trust and Trade.